Island.
New York. Friday. It's been a long week. I feel like it's been about a 3 week long week, if that's possible. But it is Friday, and I'm about
and
to
it's the
celebrate and enjoy it. What's
happening? Happy hour. Double.
Absolutely. Time for American at Radio on 90.3 WHPC. Glad to be here. I'm your host. Thank you for being here. Very glad to have you along. Love your wife, co-host, and engineer extraordinaire, Heidi Morales-Ryan here as well. And I find it hard to believe that I am about to say that we are just now about to present part 27 in our coverage of The Who, and we're just about up to 1973. Took 27 hours to cover the first decade of the band's career. Pretty amazing. But I don't think we've been milking it. I don't think we've been wasting time. I think the shows have been consistently interesting. If there's any show at all that is going to show signs of that, it might be this one, because I have just one more show that I want to cover, Pete's preparation for the album Quadrophenia. I mean, he continued to work hard on completing new material for this next theme album of the band. He desperately wanted something to replace Tommy in the live show, because the band was getting sick of playing Tommy, and they wanted to have something that would rock and that would be awesome live. And that's what Pete intended the next album to be, this thing, Quadrophenia. The band, not so patiently waiting to get started with recording. There was obviously some drunken frustration between Pete and Roger, which led to a bash-up between the two of them. Roger thought he killed him. What happened was, it's kind of simple. Roger was sitting at a studio all day waiting for the band to rehearse. Pete was in another studio all day mixing tracks to bring to the studio for the band to listen to. And Pete shows up late after his long mixing session. And Roger's like, well, screw this. I'm going home. I've been sitting here for 10 hours. You think I want to sit here and do that now? And when Pete was mixing, he was drinking. So we got a little bit cocky with Roger and told him that he would beat him up. And they were holding Roger back. Pete says, let him go. I'm going to punch him out. It took one punch from Roger, and Pete ended up knocked out cold on the floor. And Roger thought he was dead. Amazingly, you know, with these few things, I mean, somehow the band manages to get past this stuff and they start to work. But for this show, I want to play a few of Pete's demos, maybe an example or two of the band actually starting work on Quadrophenia. But we're going to start with other odds and sods. It was in June of this year that John Entwistle released his third solo album called Rigor Mortis Sets In. Now, this is amazing. John managed to squeeze out three solo albums in between The Who and their previous studio album, between Who's Next. John's got three solo albums in that stretch of time, and The Who are still waiting to make the next one. Unfortunately, the title, Rigor Mortis Sets In, was a bit too accurate, in my opinion. His first album was pretty good. I like John's first album. His second album, I agree with the critics who said that it was of questionable taste.
Yeah.
This album is just ridiculous. He had formed a new band and he called it Rigor Mortis. The cover was typical Entwistle black humor, as it showed a coffin. Inside was a photograph of a gravestone with the inscription Rock and Roll 1950-00. Never really passed away, just ran out of time. But if he had just released a definitive version of one of his own songs on the Who's album, Who's Next, why would he put on an inferior version of the same song on his third solo album? I've got to play it for you to hear it, because you'll be familiar with it at least. From the album Rigor Mortis Sets In by John Entwistle, here is his solo version of the song My Wife on 90.3 WHPC. Usually the saying goes that if you're going to cover a song, bring something to the table. What's just weird about that is John Entwistle isn't obviously covering the song because he wrote it. But there's so little difference between his solo version there and the band's version, except that it's just not quite as good as the Who's version. It's almost there, but I just don't get why he would do that. The rest of the album, I found it amusing until I really began to find it annoying. It's just it just sounds like it's beneath John to do the type of material that he was doing. He writes, this is the song that opens the album. It's called "Gimme That Rock and Roll," and it's just like this trite song about how he hates everything else. It's like Chuck Berry's "Just Gimme That Rock and Roll Music," but with about one-tenth of the clever lyrics. You'll see for yourself. I'll play a bit of it. I won't play the whole song. You can keep your classical music. You can stop your rhythm and blues. And you know what you can do with your Dixieland too. You can stick it any place you choose. Just give me that rock and roll. All I want is that rock and roll. Just give me that You get the gist of that one, I think, in its entirety once you get past the second verse. Nothing new there, but here is John Entwistle, one of the most celebrated bass players in rock and roll, considered to be the single most talented bass player in all of rock and roll, perhaps. His work up to this point is stunning. So it seems so weird to me that he would now like put cover versions of some really obvious material on his album. Like here he is grabbing a song that I believe dates from around the late 50s, 1959, perhaps. His version of, believe it or not, Mr. Bassman.
It's easy when you go one, two, three, ba 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 ba.
You mean ba 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 ba.
Mr. Bassman, you're on all the songs with the boom 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 boom. Da 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 da. Hey, Mr. Bassman, you're the hidden king of rock and roll. Ba 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 ba.
No, no, ba 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 ba.
Oh, it don't mean a thing when the lead is singing. Oh, when he goes, I. Will you teach me, the way you sing? Cause Mr. Bassman, I wanna be a bassman too. Ba-ba-ba-ba.
Try this. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.
Mr. Bassman, I really think I'm with it.
No, you get it. It just seems kind of like almost like out of place to play that on a Who show. So there is bits anyway of John Entwistle's third solo album called Rigor Mortis Sets In. Meanwhile, as I said, Pete is still writing and recording songs, I guess you would call them demos, that he intends to put onto his theme. Here's Pete describing how he came up with the idea for the band's upcoming album, Quadrophenia. This is from his autobiography, Who I Am. Quadrophenia isn't a straight narrative, but rather a kind of distorted dream view. Nick Cohn, who is the guy, by the way, responsible for suggesting that Pete put in a reference to pinball in Tommy, and that was quite a success. So Pete was going to him, he's a rock and roll writer, went to him for advice, and he had written a composite screenplay of the four members of The Who, and the character that he came up with, this composite, who he called Tommy in his screenplay entitled Rock is Dead, became Jimmy in Quadrophenia, and this is Pete talking again, and all my hero needed was a few days in which to find a way to recover from being a Who fan. I wanted everyone who listened to the album to find themselves and their own story in it, including each member of the band. If my malaise and Jimmy's was spiritual, then the members of The Who was simply going to have to bite the spiritual bullet, because it seemed to me that our fans' malaise was probably spiritual as well. Despite the setback of Lifehouse, I was still convinced that we would somehow draw creative energy from our fans. We would find ourselves in them. Here's a couple of... I like playing the outtakes because they were not used on the album, so this is the only chance I have of playing them, really, from Pete's work from this era. So let's play two back-to-back. The first track is called Anymore, and we'll follow that with a short bit that he calls Fill Number Two, apparently meant to be extraneous music in one section of the album or another, on 90.3 WHPC.
Real anymore. Is he real anymore?
Two bits that were intended for Quadrophenia, but songs that did not make the cut on that album. Actually, I have one more, and it might be a good time to play it right now before we get into the story and start playing some of the songs that did, you know, the demos of the songs that did make it. Let's play this now. It's called Wizardry, another one of Pete Townsend's compositions that ended up on the cutting room floor for the album Quadrophenia on 90.3 WHPC.
Thank you.
You know, I have to give Pete Townsend credit, a lot of credit, for the sounds that he got on his synthesizer. This is 1973, when it was still an uncommon instrument, and it wasn't often used tastefully. And there's something about the way that Pete used it that somehow has not become dated. I mean, there's plenty of synthesizer music from the 80s that sound much worse.
Oh, yeah, right?
You know?
Yeah, it just got so, like, needly or something. I don't know. This has just got, like, that... You can almost feel like you're in a chill-out room or something at a rave.
Yeah, the way that he's handling it, it's
ultra-modern.
He uses it in a rhythmic sense rather than just like a bad string section. Like,
right.
You know? And it works great. And very much like on Who's Next, you can hear that he's working to use the synthesizer as a part of a backing track that the live band might be able to accompany. But they weren't being as the band themselves, Keith wasn't as successful at that as he, or for some reason, as he was with the Who's Next sessions. And I mean, Keith Moon. So I have a feeling that Pete began to think that maybe some of those types of songs might not be a good idea for Quadrophenia. Well, getting back to his inspiration, I'm going to read this excerpt straight out of his autobiography. On a dark, wet winter weekend in the jerry-built cottage at Cleve, with the river flooding part of the lawns, the wind howling through the badly made doors and windows, my memory pulled me back to a single night when I was 19 years old. I had slept for a few hours under Brighton Pier in 1964 with my art school friend, the pretty strawberry blonde Liz Reed. We had been together for a riotous night at the Aquarium Ballroom after our gig on the night of a mod rocker street battle on the seafront. Walking along the beach in the dark, under the pier, trying to stay out of the drizzling rain, we'd come across a group of mod boys in their anoraks. They were giggling as the tide came in, getting their feet wet. We sat with them for a while. We were all coming down from taking Purple Hearts, the fashionable uppers of the period. As I thought back to that night, a sense of falling and vertigo came flooding back with the flooding river outside. I felt that same sense of depression and hopelessness. But I also felt, again, the remembered romantic warmth of nodding off on the milk train home in the early hours with Liz by my side. For a short time, we had both felt like mods. There was something wonderful in all that. We also fell in love, and yet I didn't go on another date with Liz. Never again. That moment with her was frozen, exalted, and would always be special. In the house at Cleve, the river raging outside in the blackness, as I looked back, I realized I'd worked up, or down, to this moment of epiphany for quite a few months. I wasn't actually alone. I had a wife, kids, and friends asleep upstairs in the cottage. I grabbed a notebook and anxiously and quickly, while still in this sad, lonely mood, scribbled the story featured on the inside sleeve of the original vinyl album of Quadrophenia. This was the story of Jimmy, a young mod, hopeless, stranded on a rock in the rain, wondering if he might find redemption through the recounting of his pathetic life thus far by the four members of the band he felt had once reflected him, now loved and lost, just as he had loved and lost everything else important to him as a teenage mod. Here is Pete's demo version of the track Drowned on 90.3 WHPC.
Rolling. be the sea, but I am in the water as far as I can see.
You can just hear how well Pete has prepared these demos for the band. But once again, though, he's also beginning to get a little bit ahead of himself and become his own worst enemy by making things more complicated than they have to be, just like he did with Lifehouse, only this time, thank goodness, not quite as crazy as that. But here, again, from his own autobiography, I'll let him explain it. I wanted Quadrophenia to be released in quadraphonic sound. Four channels representing the four facets of my hero Jimmy, each channel taking the form of one member of The Who. As the recording unfolded, it became clear that, technically speaking, Quadrophenia was going to be a complicated, audacious project. My Cleve studio, in his house, would make a terrific quadraphonic mixing suite, but it couldn't accommodate The Who for recording. I needed a large commercial studio whose control room included a quadraphonic speaker array I could trust. Nothing like this existed in London, so we would have to do what I'd done in Cleve and build it ourselves. I turned to Wiggy. Wiggy, our dedicated, technically driven, seemingly insane production manager, had started life with the band as Keith and John's driver, a baptism by fire. Had progressed to looking after lighting, and then to dealing with promoters on the road, booking hotels, making travel plans, and bailing us out of jail when he wasn't conspiring with us in the business of getting arrested in the first place. I explained to Wiggy that the studio at Cleve would be fine for mixing, but that the recording room there was basically a tractor garage. He invited me to check out the road crew's storage facility and tape archive in Thessaly Road in Battersea, which turned out to be a very large church hall full of road gear. What a pity we don't have enough time to turn this building into a studio in time to record the tracks, I said. Wiggy screwed up his eyes. When do you want it? Sort of now, I replied apologetically. Now, he repeated. That would be good. 6 weeks later, through Wiggy's employment of a troupe of 30 workers from an off-season circus, and with considerable help from John Alcock of Trackplan, we moved in. The large studio room was complete, massively soundproofed, lined in hardwoods, with two booths, one for grand piano, one for acoustic guitar, and another smaller corridor that doubled for guide vocal. The layout was perfect for us. I believe Ramport, as the studio was known, was the first studio in London to offer three isolation booths in this way. It meant we could record drums, bass, piano, and acoustic guitar with a guide vocal simultaneously. The sound was glorious. We hired Ronnie Lane's Mobile and used that to record the basic tracks until the work and acoustics and our own control room were sorted out. So, typically, Pete was trying to record the most ambitious and complex album of The Who's career in a studio that was still being built without a producer and in quadraphonic sound, a medium that had not yet been perfected. Here's another of those demos that he recorded at home in Cleve, his version of Is It Me on 90.3 WHPC.
No lie.
Interesting how that song ended up getting cut down to almost nothing. For the final album, he saved that last phrase that ends the song and the middle bridge about "Is it me for a moment?" which, when it did make it onto the album, that was inserted into a number of songs. It was like a recurring theme throughout Quadrophenia, but the song "Is it me" itself, which we had just heard, was dropped from the project. Or I should say, cut into pieces and then used elsewhere throughout the project. Now, again, this is Pete talking about the drummer, Keith Moon, what was happening with him at this point in time while the band is trying to get this thing together. Keith himself had a massive personal problem at this time. We all knew he was crazy about his wife, Kim, so it was hard to work out what he was doing, bringing girls in and out of the studio, behaving as though we were on the road. Meanwhile, my best friend Barney had taken to spending a lot of time at Tara House, Keith's home, ostensibly to hang out with Keith, but Barney had fallen in love with Kim. When Kim left the family home in October to file for divorce, Barney sought out my advice. He wanted my permission to pursue her. He was terribly torn between loyalty to the band and his new passion for Kim. I pleaded with him not to be a party to the breakup, as it would mean my having to choose between him and Keith. Barney gave himself some time to consider my plea and missed his moment. Kim went to stay with Ian McClagan from The Faces. A week later, Kim and Mac were an item. They fled somewhere together, leaving Keith to make death threats while Barney went back to Jan. Not for the first time, it occurred to me that I had to look no farther than right around me to find the makings of a rock opera, at least a rock soap opera. I listened to Keith on the finished Quadrophenia album. His playing was great, but I worried about him. He had lost his first great love, and I was certain the impact on his self-esteem would be massive, and it was. Here's the song that Pete wrote for Keith from Quadrophenia, the demo version of Bellboy.
A peach in the place. Stars seem to
watch out. Always running at someone's heels. You know how I feel. Always running at someone's
song that changed drastically and remarkably, very much for the better, with Keith Moon handling the chorus section of that tune. Again, back to Pete's autobiography, though. After a couple of weeks' preparation, the Ramparts recording began in earnest on June 22. Kit Lambert, their half of their manager team, pretended to be the album's producer for the first several weeks, showing up smashed, usually extremely late. He sometimes brought delicious but unwanted food from the trendy South Kensington restaurant, 88, in which he had shares. He scribbled his usual incomprehensible notes on tape boxes and for a while prevented our own engineer, Ron Nevison, from doing his job properly. By the end of the second week, I had had enough. Kit had been distracting the recording process, erasing tapes while I was out of the room, and I just snapped. Close to punching Kit, I sacked him instead. For weeks afterwards, we were visited by irritated heroin dealers trying to find him. Whew.
Yikes.
I have one track that is from the early days of the band recording in that studio. You can tell it's the band because Roger's on vocal, and you can also tell it's early because it's significantly different from what appears on the album as one of the first real lead-off tracks for Quadrophenia. Here is a previously unreleased version of the song The Real Me on 90.3 WHPC.
Yeah.
Finally, the band at work with a very early raw version, actually, of The Real Me. What makes it significantly different, not just that we finally hear Roger's voice on one of the tracks, but there are horn overdubs on the track. The work of John Entwistle. Here's Pete Townsend again from his autobiography talking about that. When John started working on the brass parts, he gathered for the purpose at least 20 or 30 magnificent trumpets, horns, and valve trombones. He could play all of them, writing out his parts on manuscript paper like an orthodox composer, and working through the recording meticulously until his lips started to go numb. He was wonderful to work with, disciplined, funny, and inspired. What he arranged and played on a whole variety of exotic brass instruments fitted my own synthesizer and string arrangements perfectly. The Who members still had that one all-important facility when we were making music. We listened to each other. All right. Well, if you listen to us next week, we're going to come back. We're going to start playing the album Quadrophenia next Friday in its entirety. We'll, obviously, it's a double album. We'll play part one next week. We'll follow up the week after with part two, of course, with loads of information that we can gather. So we'll hope you join us then. Meanwhile, we'll end with this little piece of unused piano from Pete's demos. Take care, folks. Have a great weekend. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi,